Hello and welcome to the Around the Nation podcast for the week of Monday, November 22nd. I'm Pat Coleman.
And I'm Keith McMillan.
And we come to you after a first round of the NCAA playoffs in which we knocked the Division III football season for 2010 down from 32 to 16 teams. Three road teams pulled off upsets at least by seeding, if not necessarily by the top 25 poll. And I think, Keith, the best way to go about this would just maybe run down and give our impressions of the bracket and of each game that happened on Saturday, kind of game by game. And starting at the top of the bracket with the Wesley-Muhlenberg game, Keith, I think this is a game that it pretty much went as we projected it. Certainly in terms of who won, but also I think in terms of the style of game.
Yeah, you know, Wesley is just a handful to defend for any team. And it's going to be tough. I think, you know, we got a good matchup coming up next week with maybe one of the best defenses in the country now that Wesley is moving on, and we'll talk about Montclair State in a minute. But I mean, they just come at you in so many ways, and it's such an interesting season for the Wolverines because they've been banged up. You know, they lost some of their key players, their starting quarterback, and they just keep coming at you in waves. And I think it was tough for Muhlenberg to stay with Wesley. And, you know, that's the type of matchup you see sometimes in the first round in these 1A games.
Yeah, and you know, when you let 32 teams into the playoffs, you're going to have some blowouts at either end of the bracket. There were a couple of numbers that jumped out at me, Keith. 649 yards of total offense for Wesley, and I know that you said on the blog over the weekend that they would be hard pressed to match that again against Montclair State. But another thing that I thought was interesting was, you know, Wesley has been a team throughout its postseason runs over the past few years that just has struggled with penalties, and they were under control quite a bit on Saturday, and certainly being in a blowout, winning a blowout can help that, but they were called for only three penalties for 21 yards on the afternoon.
Yeah, and I'll give you another number on top of that. You know, just one turnover. You have no interceptions, one fumble lost. You have one turnover and three penalties. You know, that's usually a sign of a pretty good game, and those are the ways that more talented teams can get beat by less talented teams, where you play an uncharacteristic game. And really nothing about that game on Saturday was uncharacteristic. Wesley scored the first 46 points of the game, you know, end up being 53-14. They got their big, tall wide receiver, Ellis Kraut, involved in the game. And he had three touchdown catches by midway through the third quarter. One was for 58 yards, one was for 2 yards to cap a 10-play drive, another one capped an 11-play drive for 18 yards. And to be honest with you, you know, to deal with a guy like that, and to deal with the rest of an offense that comes at you in waves, that, you know, they go deep at running back, they have talent at wide receiver, and, you know, even though they've lost some of their key contributors or those guys have been banged up, you know, that's still going to be a lot for any first round, you know, three loss team to deal with. And Muhlenberg just really they weren't talented enough, and they would have needed Wesley, I think, to play a poor game on Saturday, and it didn't happen.
One last number, and then we'll move on to another game. But Muhlenberg on third down, just 1 of 9 on the afternoon, so not able to necessarily move the chains either. Moving on to the second game, Keith, is the game that you were at. So I'll just throw out there Montclair State 16, Hampton Sydney 14, and let you talk about what you saw.
Well, it was sort of billed as the matchup of this really sharp offense against one of the country's best defenses. Montclair State came in ranked fifth in the country, giving up 9.7 points per game, and it turned out that way for Hampton Sydney. It wasn't tough for them to move the ball, to be honest with you, but it was tough for them to punch it in and score points, and they hurt themselves a couple times because they really did move the ball pretty well. And either whether it be with turnovers or they late in the second quarter missed a fairly short field goal. And in the third quarter, actually got two turnovers from Montclair State. Both Bill Duty and Trevor Aquile, I don't know if I say his name right, but he picked off a pass. And Hampton Sydney had the ball on Montclair State's side of the field twice, and didn't come away with much. They fumbled the ball on the 1 yard line going in, and that was the moment for me where I said this Montclair State defense really is good, because Your team's moving the ball on you a little bit, and this is the playoffs. You know, you're not going to shut teams down like you do sometimes in the regular season, but you dig deep and you find a way to make a play. And the strange thing about that play where Hampton Sydney fumbled going in is the Montclair State tried to strip it on first down, and Hampton Sydney thought it got in and scored. Turned out it was right on the goal line, and they ran another play, and they actually did pull it loose on second down. And so it wasn't just a fluke thing where they came up with this stop here. They really pulled it out. And then when Hampton Sydney finally did punch in a couple touchdowns in the fourth quarter, they trailed. Well, go back a second to this. At the point where they lost the ball going in, and they had a chance to make it 10-7. Right after that, Montclair State gets the ball. Looks like it was a blown coverage, I think, for Hampton Sydney. 78-yard touchdown pass for Montclair State. So it goes from being potentially 10-7 to 16-0. And Hampton Sydney gets rolling. And they cut it to 16-8. Because Montclair State missed a extra point, instead of 17, it was 16. Hampton Sydney had it 16-8, and they had a chance to make it 16-all when they scored, and the pass was a two-point conversion pass was broken up, so 16-14, but Hampton Sydney's crowd is into it, and the defense comes up with a big stop, and Montclair State punts the ball back to Hampton Sydney, and this is what playoff games are made of. You know, right here at this point, Hampton Sydney has the ball, getting ready to start this great drive, and Gary Knoepel for Montclair State goes up and takes this Travis Lane pass out of there. It was a deep pass, kind of a fade type of pass on the sideline, and Knoepel just went up, and it was described, I think, in the postgame as a circus interception. Like, he just went up and comes down with this great interception, and Montclair was able to more or less kill the clock from that point. So Hampton Sydney never got to mount this great drive in front of its crowd, which actually did kind of fill in a little bit. At the beginning of the game, it was sort of nothing like the Randolph-Macon crowd from the week before, but it did start to fill in, and they did get a little rowdy in the fourth quarter. And I think if you look around the bracket, I know I've been talking for like 3 minutes straight here about this game, but if you look around the bracket, there were maybe five or six games that were really these great first-round playoff games. And we knew pretty much which ones they were going to be, too, and they sort of lived up to their billing. You know, all the four or five games were pretty good, and then you had that little bracket, the Bethel Wheaton Wartburg Co. bracket that we thought was going to have some good games. But I don't know if there was a better game anywhere in the country on Saturday than this Montclair State Hampton Sydney game. You look at the scores put up by the winning teams across the board, 40s, you know, 30s. All the number one seeds were in the 50s, except for Mount Union was only 49. You had a 60-0 game. You had these scores that were sort of in the stratosphere, and then Montclair State was the only winning team to win with, you know, as few as 16 points. So some teams in the playoffs have to do it with defense, and I thought they did a great job of again, they didn't shut Hampton Sydney down by any means, but they came up with the big plays when they were necessary.
Moving on to the third game in the Wesley bracket, a game at which I think for you and Ryan Tipps, buying into WNL's real strong surge over the last 8 weeks of the season, and I also thought, although I picked Thomas More to win, I thought Washington and Lee would be much more competitive in this game, and it would end up being a shootout, and it really was not, as Thomas More kind of walked away with it 42-14.
Yeah, well, one of the keys to the game that I didn't really realize when I made that pick, but that I realized discussing a little bit after the game, the matchups with some of the coaches that were on site at Montclair State Hampton Sydney, was that Thomas More, their offense is fairly similar to what Washington Lee runs, which is this spread option attack, and that caught so many teams, I think, in the ODAC off guard, and they weren't able to adjust to it during the season. And not only that, it, Washington Lee started off kind of rough, 1-2, and then they just went on the streak where they were, you know, for lack of a better cliche or a non-cliche, they were clicking on all cylinders, and it was really remarkable to see them run through the ODAC, score at least 35 points in every game, and you thought, yeah, they're going to turn around and take that into the playoffs, because for Thomas More, how do you prepare for this, you know, kind of kooky offense in 4 days or however many practice days you have to get ready for your first playoff opponent? But if Thomas More has seen a similar offense like that every day in practice or all throughout the season, then it's not as much of an advantage. And that sort of explained to me, I guess, after the fact, why they were so successful in dealing with W&L. Now the general still rushed for 253 yards and had 323 yards offense, so they weren't really able to pass just the 70 yards. But the flip side was Thomas Moore was able to run for 432 yards, and if you can rush for that many yards, there's almost no chance you're going to lose.
You know, Keith, we're going to talk a little bit more about the second-round matchups in a little bit, but seeing that, do you feel better about Thomas Moore's chances at Mary Hardin-Baylor next week?
I think that's going to be a good game. You know, you have to pick Mary Hardin-Baylor going in. They're the favorite. And even if you go by our poll, it's, you know, number 6 Mary Hardin-Baylor, number 10 Thomas Moore. And a lot of times, especially during the season, we sort of got to those first 6 teams, and then we thought there was sort of a break in the tiers, and there was that tier afterwards, which was like Ohio Northern and Wittenberg and Trine and Thomas Moore were all in that group, that second group. You know, Linfield and Cal Lutheran and Pacific Lutheran and Warburg and Co. and all them were in that sort of the tier below the top 6. And when you look at this number 6 versus number 10, these are not seeds; these are our top 25 rankings. You know, I think this has a chance to live up to that kind of billing, where it's a game where Thomas Moore can actually go down to Belton and hang with these guys. You know, I don't know if I will pick them to win, but you see them rush for 432 yards, and the Generals weren't great on defense by any means during the season. They basically made their living outscoring everybody. But, you know, Mary Hardin-Baylor has shown some chinks in the armor as well during the season, and I know they've improved as the season got on, and they finished really on a 3-game hot streak, and they didn't have any trouble with Christopher Newport. But I think Thomas Moore will be the best team Mary Hardin-Baylor has seen, maybe going back to the Hardin-Simmons game.
And Keith, about the 59-7 win for Mary Hardin-Baylor, I'm not sure there's much more we can say about that. This was a blowout from the beginning. Christopher Newport was attempting a field goal about 2 minutes into the game, and it was blocked and returned 74 yards for a touchdown. And that was basically all she wrote almost at that very point. Ended up being 28-0 at the end of the first quarter.
Yeah, and not only that, it was, you know, Quincy Daniels had scored the next 4 touchdowns for Mary Hardin-Baylor, so they're not even 5 minutes into the second quarter. Quincy Daniels already has 4 touchdowns for them. It was, you know, basically the type of game where everything Mary Hardin-Baylor did worked. And not only that, some of those touchdown drives, if you look at their drive in the late in the first quarter, 2 plays, 31 yards, another drive, 3 plays, 3 yards, another drive, 1 play, 29 yards, tells you that they were getting the turnovers. They got the ball on their side of the field, and they didn't have to go very far to score. And whenever you have a game like that, you round up 300 or you rack up 392 rushing yards, but you do it a couple times with a short field, that means you got some turnovers and you had quite a day on defense as well as on offense.
In the North bracket, a 1-8 game, it was typical of the other 1-8 games, with North Central beating St. Norbert 57-7.
Yeah, the number that jumps out there, of course, is the 619 to 217 total offense. You know, anytime you rush, you round up, rack up is the phrase I'm looking for, 619 yards. And you know, you do it kind of diversely with a little bit of passing, a little bit of rushing. Then, you know, you had a nice day. And I think the thing for North Central is that, you know, they're carrying this burden right now of being the number one seed in the bracket, while Whitewater's the number two seed and the number one team in the country in the polls. And then you also have Ohio Northern looming in the bracket, and then you have Trine, who looked really good on Saturday. So, you know, North Central is the number one seed in the bracket, but no guarantees they're going to get through. And for them to come out and win 57-7, it's probably good for them, for their confidence, just to build that back and remember that we are as good as we're built to be, and if we play well, you know, we've got a chance against anybody left in these playoffs.
For St. Norbert, you know, this is really a team that is not far from the best St. Norbert teams, not as good as the St. Norbert team that got left out of the playoffs last year. They were young up front, and you know, they finished 7-3. They lost 2 conference games in the Midwest Conference, and this was, you know, I wouldn't think if I were them that I would be too disappointed with the way the season ended. I would hope they wouldn't think it ended on too much of a down note, getting blown out in this game.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's number 5 team in the country, North Central is. And for St. Norbert, which was kind of the same way Washington Lee was, you know, down early in the season and rallied. You know, in St. Norbert's case, they were trailing in the North, in the Midwest Conference race for much of the season, you know, and that was one of those conferences where every week it looked like somebody different was in the lead or some different team was more impressive. But once, you know, Monmouth lost Alex Tanney and they lost a couple of games early, and then it was sort of wide open, and it was Grinnell and Ripon and Carroll and Beloit all around the top of that conference, and you know, it ended up being St. Norbert. So yeah, Pat, I think you do, you know, make the point that they have something to be proud of this season, and it also shows that the playoff system that we have isn't perfect, because it doesn't always reward the best version of a school's team, and you're right, they were probably a little bit better last season, but you know, there's no embarrassment, I guess, in losing to North Central, but you certainly don't want to lose 57-7, you know, give up 279 yards rushing, 295 yards passing. North Central really didn't have any trouble. I think they scored on their first nine possessions, so it wasn't St. Norbert's best effort, I think, but all the 1-8 games weren't good games. I mean, the 8 seeds just weren't really weren't able to hang, to be quite honest. And that goes back to what we said last week, you know, prior to the playoffs, that there really is an abundance of quality, not just in Pool C, which we'll talk about, I'm sure, at some point, but also at the top. These number one and number two seeds this year are really, really good.
The next game in that bracket's the 4-5 game between Ohio Northern and Wittenberg. This is one of the games, Keith, where the D3Football.com top 25 and the coaches poll disagreed. The coaches poll had Wittenberg ranked ahead of Ohio Northern. We had Ohio Northern ranked ahead of Wittenberg, and Ohio Northern jumped out quick. It was a 17-0 game at the end of the first quarter, 24-0 by halftime, and 37-14 final.
Yeah, and sometimes, you know, the flaw we often point out about the coaches poll is that it looks a little too much at record and moves undefeated teams very high up the poll, and I thought even our poll had Wittenberg a little high at number 9. You know, they were 10-0, and we harped on their schedule a lot this season, and just as we harped on Trine's schedule, and they kind of did fine on Saturday, but I think it speaks a little bit to the quality of teams each of them faced. And for Ohio Northern, a team that's 9-1 with a 27-0 loss to Mount Union, I think, of the season, you know, there's no shame, of course, in losing to Mount Union. And again, it reinforces what we've sort of learned over the years, that number two team in the OAC is usually just as powerful as a conference champion from somewhere else, and there just isn't too many other ways to measure it except for when the teams get on the field together.
Yeah, over the course of the expanded playoffs, the Ohio Athletic Conference is 55-13 in the postseason, and a lot of those 13 losses, though not all of them, are the conference runner-up losing to Mount Union over the course of the bracket. So let's talk about that other game. You mentioned Trine, and they beat DePauw 45-35. Trine ends up with an easier opponent in the first round by every measure, really, and does what we would expect them to. And Ohio Northern, I don't know, gets punished for some reason by having to play Wittenberg, or Wittenberg gets punished by having to play Ohio Northern, however you want to look at it. Trine had a much easier path, and they succeeded on it.
Yeah, and the strange thing, of course, was not just that Trine played DePauw, but that DePauw hosted that game, and they were coming off the 47-0 loss to rival Wabash in week 11, and you didn't know how they were going to bounce back, and it certainly didn't start off well for them. They fell behind 27-7 to the Thunder early on, but they rallied, get ahead 28-27, and I think if you have to point to a game, you know, I said the Montclair State Hampton City game may have been the best game, period, but the best game to watch may have been this DePauw Trine game, because it was Trine out early, DePauw jumping back in front, and then Trine came back and finished pretty strong.
Yeah, at one point it was 27-7 Trine, and this was before the first quarter was over. And yeah, I'm sure if you're a DePauw fan, or even if you're a Wabash fan, you look at that score coming across and think, wow, the wheels are falling off for the Tigers the exact same way they did the previous week. But then all of a sudden, 21 unanswered points for DePauw, and we're up 28-27 with a whole lot of time left in the football game.
Yeah, and that sort of speaks to what kind of team they were. They're certainly pretty resilient to battle back from that 20-point deficit in the first quarter, and it got bad, too. You know, it happened fast to them. You know, They were down 14-7, then they a fumble recovery, made it 20-7, and a 60-yard touchdown pass on a one-play drive, made it 27-7, and they had to chip away at it. 10-play drive in the second quarter, 11-play drive in the third quarter, another 7-play drive to take the lead midway through the third, and they felt good again. And then Eric Watt found Javonte Hintz again for another big pass play. He's the one who caught the 60-yard pass play in the first quarter, caught a 59-yard touchdown to put Trine ahead 35-28 at the end of the fourth. And then that game was tied at 35, you know, early in the fourth quarter. So it was really one of the better games on Saturday in terms of being back and forth, fun to watch, and Trine was just able to close it out. You know, their last drive was 12 plays, and they kicked a 24-yard field goal with Jeremy Howard to give him that 10-point lead, but the 12 plays was almost the bigger part of that drive because they milked 4.5 minutes off the clock when DePaul really needed to get the ball back.
So Trine goes on to play University of Wisconsin-Whitewater, which I think played the most interesting blowout on Saturday. It's just another testament to the depth of these top programs that you can lose your starting quarterback, be playing a top 25 team in the first round of the playoffs, struggle a little bit early, and then end up blowing them out by 31 points.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we know from having seen Whitewater play, both of us have seen them play this year, that their depth, their strength is really in their lines, and especially on the offensive line and in their running game, so that, you know, if you have to play without Matt Blanchard, you know, who had a thumb injury, and whether you choose to sit him out or whether, you know, you lose him during the course of the game, this is a team that can sort of, even though it doesn't really have much experience behind Matt Blanchard, but it can lean on its running game to pull things out. And, you know, they were able to throw the ball a little bit. You know, a couple of their big touchdowns in the second half came on pass plays, and they got those great receivers, you know, Aaron Roosh and Adam Brandis. Those are guys got Stag Bowl experience, you know, played 15 games a year for the past few years. So they're certainly sharp. And Lee Brecke did a nice job in relief. You know, they didn't abandon their passing game, but I think this is a team that if that passing game gets taken away or if they don't have their starting quarterback, they can lean on Lavelle Coppedge. You know, he scored a 55-yard touchdown run early to give them a little bit of breathing room. And, you know, they can lean on Booker Stanley and they can lean on Antoine Anderson if they have to go that deep down the roster. And Whitewater didn't tear it up running-wise. As a team, they only rushed for 157 yards, But that's a team that can run its way out of a hole a little bit and give its quarterback time.
I think part of that is the difference of not having Matt Blanchard under center. You've got Breck, who's, you know, making his first career start. He got sacked three times, ends up with you know, negative 26 yards rushing. And if you turn that around into a positive, where, you know, Blanchard is going to get out of the pocket and run those times instead of taking those sacks, I think that's a big part of a difference. It would probably be maybe a 50-yard swing in the ground game.
Yeah, but, you know, he did a nice job. I mean, if you look at his final passing numbers, 23 of 30, 294 yards, 4 touchdowns, no interceptions. And the big numbers there are the 23 of 30 and the no interceptions. You know, you have a guy, even though he's your backup and he doesn't have much experience, he comes in and doesn't make a lot of mistakes, makes the right reads. And that probably goes back to, you know, not just coaching, but this team having a pretty nice offensive line. And if Franklin isn't able to really, even though you did mention those sacks, if Franklin isn't able to keep up that pressure over the course of the game and he's able to get comfortable and get in a rhythm, as clearly Whitewater's offense did in the second half, you know, they're able to pull away in that game. And you got to tip the hat, I think, to Franklin a little bit in this one, because they're the only they're the only 7 or 8 seed, I guess, you know, taking away the Wheaton Co game, which was Co wasn't really a true 7 seed in our minds. I mean, they were pretty talented to be seeded that low. But the only real mismatch game where the lower seeded team put up a fight.
Keith, the one thing that we talked about in terms of Whitewater and weaknesses or spots where they were untested was the secondary, and we mentioned the big passing day that Franklin had, especially early, and they ended up, of course, completing 40 passes that they had to throw 72 times to do it. But certainly the defensive backs got worked a little bit, and you'd have to think they have a lot of things that they've seen on film to go back and work on this week in preparing for Trine.
I would say that's definitely part of it because, you know, trying, they're going to throw the ball with Eric Watt, guy who's you know, one of the better quarterbacks in the country, and he passed for well over 300 yards against DePaul. So, you know, they're going to try to go up top a little bit against the Warhawks and exploit whatever weaknesses they have. But I think part of it, too, is that's who Franklin is. Franklin is a wide-open passing team, and even though, you know, they don't have the Chad Rupp, the guy that we've heard of and that has put up these exorbitant numbers, they're still a passing team, and the 40 for 72, you know, it's not ideal for them, but the 373 yards passing is probably pretty normal for a Franklin team, and you know, the number I think that hurt them a little bit was giving up 6 sacks and just not being able to make any more plays when they got this game to 31-21, you know, late in the third quarter. And we've seen it over the years, really. You know, there was a Wartburg-Whitewater playoff game that was close in the third quarter. There was a Lacrosse-Whitewater playoff game that was close in the third quarter. A lot of teams can hang with Whitewater, but nobody can muster that strength over the last 15 or 20 minutes of the game to really finish strong the way the Warhawks do.
So in the Mount Union bracket, Mount Union 49-0 in a game where, you know, basically, you'd have to think Mount Union could pretty much name its score. It posted the shutout and kept the score within reason.
Yeah, we didn't expect a whole lot out of St. Lawrence with the 5-5 record going out to Mount Union. You know, we've seen very good teams get beaten pretty badly there in Alliance, and 49-0 probably wasn't as bad as some people expected it to be, but it's certainly, you know, nothing good. And the you know, the things that stand out, of course, is the zero. Mountain Union sometimes has these great offensive players, and we get so enamored with them, we forget that these guys are built on a pretty solid foundation of great defense, good offensive line play, and then you have the quarterback and the offensive skill position players that are really exceptional as well. And Mountain Union does have an exceptional skill position player, Cecil Shorts. You know, missed some games this season with that toe injury. And he's now got 7 touchdowns the past 2 weeks. He had 8 catches for 139 yards on Saturday against St. Lawrence, 3 touchdowns, and he had 4 touchdowns in week 11 against Muskingum. So, you know, he's back. And for a mediocre team, for a 5-5 type team, for a, you know, type of team Muskingum is, he's going to be a difference maker in a game. And as we move down the line here, you know, Delaware Valley coming up next, they're going to have to find a way to stop him. If they don't have a player on their roster that can handle him one-on-one, and I'm willing to say they probably don't, that they're going to have to devote some extra resources to covering Shorts, and then that opens up things for Kyle Miller and the rest of this offense.
100 yards of total offense on the afternoon for St. Lawrence. They didn't convert a single third down. Those are the numbers along the defensive line that you're talking about. And, you know, on the offense, again, the foot gets taken off the gas. Neil Seaman plays basically one possession in the second half. They have a 3-play 58-yard touchdown drive, and then it's the backups from that point. And the backup, Matt Pelotto, was 9 of 11 for 87 yards. He's a guy who had been talked about getting some perhaps getting some significant playing time this year, and here getting a chance to do it in a postseason game.
And that's, you know, one of the reasons people always say Mount Union is so well prepared for going deep down the line and turning around its next big team, because those guys are getting playoff experience. They're getting, you know, maybe 5 more weeks of experience every year than everyone else. You know, another advantage that Mountain Union has on pretty much everyone everywhere is having the best coach in college football, and Larry Karras won his 300th game on Saturday, and we certainly should acknowledge that, because not only did he win number 300, but it only took him about 325-something-some-odd games to, yep, do it. I think his record is now 322-1. The ties are the number I always forget, but the 22 losses is tremendous. And he's in position now, before the end of this playoffs, to move up to number 8 on the all-time list. Right now he's tied with Delaware's Tubby Raymond at 300, and Frosty Westering is at number 9 on that list, and he's in Larry Karras's sights.
Yeah, it is. It's 3 ties, I believe. Well, it is 325 games, and 300 wins in 325 games makes him the fastest to get to 300 wins in the history of college football, from what I've seen. So, yeah, it's hard to imagine, but if if he keeps rolling off wins at, you know, 15 a year, 400 is not too far off. And then, obviously, John Gilardi is going to keep winning games until he stops coaching. And I think stops coaching for him is synonymous with him dying. I don't see how they get him out of that job. But, you know, I understand, and I've heard that Larry Karras doesn't want to coach that long. He doesn't want to coach until he's 80 or maybe even 70. But, you know, he's got a chance to rack up some serious win totals at the rate he's going.
Yeah, Pat, you pointed out the fact that you know, he may not catch John, and it's going to be a while before he catches Bobby Bowden or Joe Paterno. But he can jump up to sixth on this list pretty quickly. You know, he'll pass, you know, some pretty famous names in maybe Bear Bryant and Amos Alonzo Stagg at some point pretty soon here if he keeps going at the clip that he's going.
So Mount Union next week will face Delaware Valley. And Delaware Valley defeated Salisbury by the score of 23-12. Salisbury got some stuff put together late, but for them it seems to be what it was, as it always is, for them or most triple option teams, inability to take care of the football.
I think that and the inability to be multidimensional in the playoffs. You know, when you get a good defense, and Delaware Valley certainly has one of those, you know, you just take a look at the stat sheet. You say, wow, Salisbury rushed for 5.4 yards per play. They had 280 yards rushing. Sounds like a pretty good day, right? Well, they only passed for 20 yards. They were a 2-of-7 passing, and one of those passes was picked off. So they were one-dimensional, and when they needed a key play, they fell behind in that game, 23-0. So for them to they want to stick with that run, but they want to be able to mix in the pass. They want to lull you to sleep and then hit you with a big, deep passing play. You know, the component to that triple option offense, at least the way Salisbury likes to run it, is run you to sleep and then hit you with a huge passing play. And they were never able to do that against Delaware Valley, again, finishing with just the 20 yards passing. And falling behind, it's tough to come back, to stick to that option, because it takes so much time because you're killing clock.
Yeah, and Salisbury ends up the afternoon minus 5 in turnovers. You mentioned the interception. They fumbled the ball 7 times and they lost 4 of them. And that, you know, being minus 5, I'm fairly certain, I don't have hard stats on this, but I'm pretty sure it's hard to win that way. Moving on to the next game in the bracket.
Yes.
Yeah, Alfred and Maritime. Alfred 60-0, and when I predicted, I think it was 31-8 in triple take, I thought, you know, I'd like to go higher, but I didn't want to be, you know, too disrespectful of what Maritime's done this season, and I thought maybe there would be a little bit of extra inspiration considering all that's going on there behind the scenes, but it just didn't really seem to matter. Alfred was blowing the doors off 50-0 by halftime, and at that point, what else is there to say?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what I have to say is that I saw SUNY Maritime play early in the season, and I knew they weren't as talented as most of the teams in the playoffs, but they drew about the best matchup they could have hoped for. You know, even though it's an Empire 8 team and that's a power conference, Alfred lost 2 games during the season to not Empire 8 teams. You know fairly, they lost to Rochester and RPI, so, you know, teams from the Liberty League, teams that the league that had a down season. And, you know, it's a 2-loss team, an unranked team. I mean, they couldn't have really asked for a much better matchup. You feel like, you know, maybe there are 5 or 6, you know, worst teams, I guess, in the postseason. And I don't mean to say that Alfred is bad. They certainly have a chance to beat Cortland State this week. But, I mean, just looking at the resume coming in, there were only 9 teams with multiple losses. And Maritime was 10-0. Probably should have, well, they should have been playing that game at home, but didn't have the facilities. And had to go up to Alfred, but it wasn't like a monster road trip where, you know, Maritime hadn't gone that far all season. So it was sort of all set up for Maritime to continue this storybook season that they had. Remember, their coach, Clayton Kendrick Holmes, is shipping out for active duty at the end of the year. And I know he never really wanted to make this season about him, but because it brought his program so much exposure, you know, he did go along with it when they asked him. And The players responded to it. You know, they wanted to win one for the coach, and it just wasn't in the cards on Saturday. Alfred, you know, obviously bigger, stronger, tougher, faster in all phases of the game, in 60-0. There really isn't a whole lot of explanation for it. Pat, when I picked my score, I thought Maritime's the intangibles, the inspiration, the scrappiness that team had would keep them close, and it would end up being a pretty good game. But it wasn't any of that, and you know, I just missed by a mile on my pick because we got a little caught up with the sentimental part of it and not with the fundamental part.
Well, we both picked them to win, and I see it all the time on the message boards. The W is all that matters, right? So at least we got that going for us. Yeah, the other thing is, of course, that Maritime's Conference, the Eastern Collegiate Football Conference, gets an automatic bid next year. So, you know, as the field becomes more and more filled with automatic bids, and there are fewer options to take, you know, to be honest with you, they're not going to be taking a spot away from a Pool C team, but they're going to be taking a spot away from a Pool B team. And if this season played out, if next season plays out like this season played out. You know, Wesley's still in the field. Salisbury's not in the field. SUNY Maritime gets an automatic bid, and Salisbury stays home. And clearly, from the way games were played on Saturday, that's not for the betterment of the playoff field. There's certainly we're making an exchange and getting a pretty bad team in the field, unless something very drastic happens to the ECFC and the UMAC, for that matter, in the next 12 months.
Pat, I'm glad you mentioned the UMAC, because I want to point out that you know, if this is next year, Greenville is in the playoffs, and somebody else isn't, and that's a team that's probably cut from the same cloth as Maritime, where you know they can have a good season within their league, but it takes a lot for teams in these not as good conferences to step up and play well against teams from good conferences. And I know Greenville has been one of the few teams from those conferences that has stepped out and played teams from the power conferences, but it's still going to be a big difference next year when we get an ECFC automatic bid and a UMAC automatic bid.
Yeah, I mean, if I had to right now slot Greenville as to where they stood in this year's playoff bracket, you know, I did not see Maritime play, and I did see Greenville play, but, you know, Greenville's resume showed and proved a little bit more maybe than Maritime's did. I think they're better than Benedictine. We could probably draw a pretty direct line to show that. They might be competitive with St. Norbert, but they're still, you know, even though Greenville had a fairly decent season and is talented for their level, they'd still be pretty far down there. And adding those two automatic bids is going to drag down the playoff field quality a little bit, even if it doesn't take away from somebody else's at-large bid. Moving on to the last of these games in the Mount Union bracket, and Cortland State beat Endicott 49-35. I think that final score is kind of misleading, Keith. Endicott only ended up with 234 yards of total offense, and they put up a couple of late touchdowns to make it seem a little bit closer than it was.
Yeah, don't be fooled by that final score, 49-35. You know, it was 42-14 with 9 minutes left in that game. Cortland rolled up 429 yards of offense, and Cortland is right there with Montclair, Wesley, Mount Union as the best defenses in these playoffs and in the country all season long. And for them to give up 35 points would have been a real eye-opener if, you know, 21 of it wasn't against the second unit or when the game was out of reach. So for Cortland State, you know, that was one of the games, I think, on Saturday that didn't draw much attention. And rightfully so, I guess it sort of ho-hum when NJAC champion, you know, beats the NFC champion in the first round of the playoffs, and for the NFC, it's sort of a step back, because 2 years ago they had that big upset when Curry went up to Ithaca and won, and they got two teams in the playoffs, and I think they really felt like that was going to be a step forward for them as a conference, and it just hasn't materialized.
In the St. Thomas bracket, we start with St. Thomas scored touchdowns on their first five possessions. Dakota Tracy looks to have set the playoff record for best completion percentage in a game. He was 15 of 16, and I didn't see anything else better than that on Saturday, breaking a record that was less than a year old. Wittenberg's Aaron Hoffman was 11 and 12 before getting knocked out of the Whitewater game last year in the quarterfinals. But, you know, St. Thomas is just another one of those 1-8 games where they beat Benedictine 57-10.
Yeah, and you know, the 50 points is pretty typical across the board for the one seeds. 644 yards of offense for St. Thomas. Had Ben Wortman, 14 carries for 149 yards. Colin Tobin, just 7 carries to get 154 yards. He had a 91-yard run. you know, I think when your offensive line is bigger and tougher and stronger than the other guys, you sort of can impose your will on them, and that's the way St. Thomas did it on Saturday.
They're going to face Linfield, which avenged its early season loss to Cal Lutheran, coming back and beating the Kingsmen 42-26.
That's a team you got to get familiar with, the Linfield Wildcats, because they dropped off the radar by losing that game way back in week one, and they didn't drop off the radar, but they moved out of the group of elite teams, and they started out the season in the top five. You lose your first game, and now we've had a group of six pretty much at the top this year, and when we were looking around as we were all doing our predictions for a team that could crack that group and maybe sneak into the Final Four, maybe beat Mount Union on this side of the bracket, and that would be certainly a remarkable turnaround for a team that lost its first game. But Linfield's got that elite level talent. Remember, they were right in that game last year in the semifinals against Whitewater in the fourth quarter. A lot of the same key pieces back. When we talk about Aaron Boehm at quarterback, we talk about some of the running backs and receivers, you know, that we've gotten to know over the past few years. But I think the guy you really need to get to know if you're following Linfield from afar is Eric Hayden, and I hope I'm saying his last name correctly, because he had three sacks on Saturday, and that gives him 21 for his career. And he shows no signs of stopping. If St. Thomas is as good up front as they, you know, purport to be, then they're going to have to be able to find a way to block this guy, because he just wreaks havoc in the backfield, and in turn that sort of cuts the rest of the defense loose.
I don't know how to pronounce Hayden's last name. I'll have to find out by Saturday, because I will be at St. Thomas. I'm really interested to see Aaron Boehm, having seen him last year early on in the season, when I thought that maybe some of the playbook was kept under wraps in an early season game against Occidental. Then he looked completely different against Whitewater in the national semifinals, and then to see how they look coming out to Minnesota when St. Thomas went to Linfield and was kind of held at arm's length for pretty much the entire game. That it wasn't a blowout, but they were multiple scores down for a fairly long stretch of that football game last year. So to see Linfield come into St. Thomas, I think the winner of this game wins the bracket. And when I wrote up my half of the, or my part of the St. Thomas bracket for the predictions column last week, that's basically what I was thinking in my mind. So I'm interested to see if this game actually lives up to the billing.
Yeah, and that's definitely a game in the West that's going to have top billing, because you know the same way that Cal Lutheran or the same way that Linfield was eager to avenge its loss to Cal Lutheran, and they were certainly quite fortunate to be able to play that game at home, because Cal Lutheran earned the higher seed, and if they hadn't been, redoing their field, they would have hosted that game at home. But Linfield got the chance to have that loss, went ahead and did it 42-26, and you know, the same emotion that Linfield had to go and play Cal Lutheran again, I think St. Thomas has that emotion and is going to bring that into Saturday's game against Linfield, because you go back to last season, and Linfield was the team that ended the Tommy season. And this game, that game's going to be in St. Paul. St. Thomas gets a chance to host that game. Linfield is the one that has to make the big trip from the Pacific Northwest. And it sort of continues in annual tradition, late November, early December, between these West Region teams. You know, you go back to the early 2000s, and it was PLU out of the Northwest Conference against St. John's from the MIAC. And over the years, you know, the team names have changed, but there have always been that big rivalry between the Northwest Conference and the MIAC for supremacy in the West. And, you know, last two seasons, it's been the Wildcats and the Tommies. And I think this is going to be a big one because St. Thomas really, I'm sure, is pretty eager to have another shot at Linfield.
Just looking ahead at the advanced 10-day forecast here for the Twin Cities, snow and 21 degrees on Thanksgiving Day, but then partly cloudy and 23, mostly sunny and around freezing on Saturday. So it won't be, at least if the forecast holds up, it won't be completely inclement weather for that second round game between St. Thomas and Linfield. And then moving down to this final octet, no, quadrant, half a quadrant of the bracket, these four teams, with Bethel beating Wartburg 28-20, and then not to pair these up, but just talk right now about Wheaton as well. Wheaton beating Coe 31-21. These teams and these games, even though they were the 3-6 and the 2-7, they turned out to be the great games that we thought they were.
Yeah, I think we thought all along that those four teams were about as evenly matched as any other foursome in the bracket. You know, Bethel went to Wartburg and won at Wartburg, and you know, Coe had a big lead going into the fourth quarter at Wheaton, and those games, you know, you look at where they were in our poll. Wartburg was 11th, Coe was 13th, Bethel 14, Wheaton 15, and those are the only two games in the entire bracket, Bethel number 14 and Wheaton number 15, where the team that we had ranked lower in the D3Football.com poll went ahead and won. So, you know, you could call those games upsets, but they were pretty tight matchups, and we thought they would be. And Bethel, you know, needed a couple of big fourth down plays to win 28-20. And Wheaton needed a huge fourth quarter to win 31-21. So, you know, we got what we thought we'd get from those games. And I think the other thing to note about this foursome was that three of those teams were Pool C teams, in Bethel, Wheaton, and Coe, and they all got matched together. And, you know, Pool C, only games they lost on Saturday were to other Pool C teams, so they did pretty well. They acquitted themselves well on Saturday.
Yeah, and none of the Pool C teams got blown out either. As we certainly had some great games here. One of the things out of the Bethel Wartburg game, Mitch Hallstrom, freshman wide receiver, his sister was getting married the day that Bethel played St. Thomas, and I can hear all of you at home thinking, how could she possibly schedule her wedding for a football Saturday, knowing her brother was going to be playing college football? I don't know if maybe she didn't think that Mitch had it in him to be a key contributor for Bethel as a freshman, or just spaced out or what. But Hallstrom, 6 catches for 119 yards and a touchdown against Wartburg, and also threw a 37-yard pass as well. That was a really key missing piece, and certainly a big part of why Bethel only ended up scoring 6 points in that loss to St. Thomas in the regular season.
Yeah, and you know, now that they've got that offense, you know, they've got the quarterback, you know, and they got the running back in Logan Flannery, a guy who's been on the map now for several years in Division III. He had a big day on Saturday with the 23 carries for 137 yards and a touchdown. But yeah, to have that threat now in the receiving game really does make a big difference. Again, 6 catches for 119 yards and a touchdown. The 37-yard pass was a key play in that game. And Pat, you know, to answer your original wonder, I think it's nobody scheduling their wedding thinks about anything else but their wedding. That's what I think it is.
Fair enough. Fair enough. I have never been a bride, and I've got 2 daughters. But I don't have to deal with that for at least a decade, right? The other game, about Wheaton and Coe, you mentioned the big comeback, fourth quarter comeback, 22 points in the fourth quarter for Wheaton. This is a team which wasn't sure it was going to have its number one quarterback. Jordan Roberts is playing with a broken hand. He was having trouble taking the snap all week. There was talk of having him play entirely out of the shotgun, but whatever happened, it worked. 18 to 24 passing for 221 yards. And he was also the number 2 rusher for the team with 52 yards, including a 36-yard run. That's a big difference for them in a game where, you know, you came in with 2 real quality quarterbacks, especially if Roberts was healthy, because Brad Boyle on the other side was no pushover either.
No, and you know, he staked Coe to a 21-9 lead going into the fourth quarter. You know, I think they had to feel good about where they were sitting, you know, especially after he caps a really quick drive early in the third quarter, and then caps a 9-play, 85-yard drive in the later in the fourth quarter with a 2-yard run. And Coe is up 21-9, feeling good about where it sits, you know, and just feel like we have to continue doing what we're doing and close this game out for the next 20 minutes. And I think for the last third of that game, you know, Wheaton just outplayed Coe and rallied back to win.
So that's the field of 16, or the round of 16. They're set. You know, Keith, if you had some overall thoughts about the bracket as well as we start looking ahead to the second round.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really excited about what we end up with, because Now, as we mentioned, the first round sort of leaves you with some of these mismatches, and that's just the nature of the beast. And, you know, every now and again you get one of those low-ranked teams that plays really well in an early game, but a lot of those games are not competitive. And when you see the blowouts in the playoffs, you tend to see them early on, and I don't think we're going to have a whole lot this week if you look at these matchups. You look at them by rank. We have 9 of the top 10 teams still alive in the country, 12 of the top 16, you know, the only top-ranked teams that lost on Saturday were teams playing other top-ranked teams. Again, these are just going by our poll numbers, but number 9 team in the country is out from losing to number 7. That's Wittenberg in North Central. Number 11, Team Wartburg, lost to number 14, Bethel, and then you have number 13, Cole, lost to number 15, Wheaton. Everybody else that's left, you know, it is a high-ranked team, and we've got these 6 teams that we thought were really, really solid. Then you got Ohio Northern and Linfield right behind that. So the top 8 teams in the country all still alive and got some great matchups on Saturday. You know, Wesley Montclair State got that high-powered offense from Wesley. Montclair State has the great defense. Thomas More, Mary Harden Baylor, you know, 2 running games that were exceptional on Saturday. You'll see if they can carry that forward to the next round. I think North Central is going to get a good test from Ohio Northern, and it goes back to what we always say here in the North region. You got the second strongest team in the OAC. Are they as good as any other team in the North region? Usually comes down to the CCIW champion that they have to beat. Tryon's got a huge challenge. You know, this is a program that wants to be on the map, is clamoring for a little bit of respect, clamoring for a little bit of notice nationally. Didn't play too many tough teams during the season, so they got a tough team to play on Saturday, and that's the defending national champions. Showed a little bit of weakness, but finished strong, and I'm pretty sure the Warhawks are going to be excited to play Tryon, just as Tryon is excited to get a chance at playing against the best. Flip over to that other side of the bracket, Mount Union. You know, didn't look bad at all on Saturday, but had some moments during the season where people thought they were human. And you got Delaware Valley, of course, that had its human moment in week 11, losing on a really great last drive by Widener, but turned around, played great defense against Salisbury, shut down that triple option attack, and advanced. And now they have their chance to go out and prove themselves. The same way we're saying Tryon has a chance to prove itself against Mountain Union, Tryon gets to play against Whitewater, Delaware Valley gets to go out to Mountain Union in the second round and potentially pull the upset. Upstate New York, you got the Empire 8 champion, you got Cortland State, you know, 2 of the strongest teams around pretty much every year this time. Cortland State, great defense. Alfred put up 60 on Saturday. We'll see how that works out. We talked about Linfield and St. Thomas, that great matchup in the history there, and then Bethel and Wheaton, a couple schools that have played each other in the regular season for the past few years. The schools have a lot in common in terms of the style of student life on campus and the success of their football programs, to be quite honest. They've been great teams for several years now, and when Bethel and Wheaton get together, you know, it may be something of a friendly affair, but it'll be a pretty rough game on the field. So I'm excited about these 8 matchups we have on Saturday, the 16 teams left in the playoffs. You know, we got, again, 12 of them are ranked in the top 15 in the country. So we got a great group left, and I'm excited about these games. I hope everybody else out there is too.
I'm still chuckling over comparing a student life on campus for Bethel and Wheaton. You're absolutely correct there. And then, you know, of course, Wheaton came up to Bethel last year and won on the last play of the game. They have a chance to go down to Wheaton and try to avenge that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see what there is about this week to not be excited about, because again, even in the places where the big name teams have have the matchups against the teams that aren't quite as established in the playoffs, I think those teams that have a little bit to be excited about in terms of, you know, again, Montclair State having a great defense maybe has a chance to slow down Wesley. And Montclair State won at Wesley a few years ago, so, you know, it shouldn't be too big a deal for them. You know, Delaware Valley's played all the best teams in the East. You know, they hung with Wesley earlier in the year. They might as well play one of the best teams in the country in Mount Union, and again, trying, you know, clamoring for that respect. Now you have the chance to earn it. So, should be a lot of fun.
And we know for fans it's a bit of a compressed week. We've got the holiday on Thursday. You know, if you're traveling, you might be away from the site for a couple of days. We're still going to have, you know, regular feature stories throughout the week as we get you ready for the second round of playoffs. I got a nomination this morning for Play of the Week. I thought maybe we might not end up doing that during the playoffs because there are so few games. But, you know, there were 16 first-round games. There were 7 ECAC postseason bowl games. So maybe we'll get enough video nominations to put something from that together. If you're a coach or an SID listening to this, the nomination deadline for D3Football.com, all region awards, and by extension, our All-American awards, are a week from Tuesday. Don't wait till the last minute because we've got, you know, a new nomination system with the switch over to Presto Sports. You don't want to be trying to nominate next Tuesday afternoon on the 30th and realize you don't have the right password or you don't know how to find what you're looking for. So nominations for that are open, and then we hope to release that sometime between the quarterfinal and semifinal rounds. We want to release our All-American team during the Stag Bowl broadcast in Salem, Virginia. Keith, of course, with Around the Nation, the column is off this week, as it is during the playoffs, so he's furiously preparing his postseason year in review, the first installment of which we will aim for the weekend of the Stag Bowl. And then, you know, we still got other things going on this week, so check back through the site. Even if your team was eliminated this week, there's still plenty of interesting football action, or even if your team didn't make it this far. Follow your conference, especially if you're, say, from the NJAC or the CCIW or the MIAC or OAC. Those four teams make up half of the playoff field that's remaining, so there's plenty of football to be played as we get on the road to Salem. So for Keith McMillan, I'm Pat Coleman, and that's the Around the Nation podcast for Week 12.